in the picture I look, and I think that's a real issue, because there's not a definition in this bill, and therefore, it's gonna be real hard to determine where that line is.
Create one. Well, we, that may be a challenge.
Maybe that's something we ought to do.
Well, I'd be happy to help you create a definition.
Well, we're still in public hearing. Our next witness up is Lynn Parton. Lynn Parton. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Parton, and I represent the Women's Rights Coalition, which is a private nonprofit statewide organization comprised of a number of other private nonprofit organizations, including the Oregon Student Association, Oregon Women's Political Caucus, the American Association of University Women, League of Women Voters, and others. We are here to testify in opposition to House Bill 3583. I'll be extremely brief. If you look, for instance, at the second page of Dr. Thorne's testimony, you see not only, you see also how difficult it is as a procedure if you take this at face value for the woman as well. And if you, even if you believe that people are irresponsible with regard to fetuses, with regard certainly to their own discomfort and extreme discomfort as described here, you have to believe, I've got to believe, that people do not undertake procedures like this lightly. So you're talking about medical emergencies, you're talking about extreme circumstances, and under those circumstances, we believe definitely that these, like any other medical procedures, need to be left to a doctor and a woman for a decision on a case-by-case basis. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate
Thank
you coming this morning. Representative Close popped in before, but does anyone know if she's coming back? I've got
well, the committee.
I'll keep that option open in case she returns. David Fidanke. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon, testifying in opposition to House Bill 3583. Mr. Chair, I came here this morning prepared to testify on the original bill.
That's fine. I understand that.
I thought it was important that the committee understand that certainly a great majority of the so-called partial birth abortion bans that have been passed in states around the country have been permanently enjoined by courts after having been reviewed. For many reasons, the ACLU has opposed such bans. I understand whoever has drafted the Dash 6 amendments is attempting to cure some of the most obvious defects in those versions of those statutes in other states. I'm not prepared at this time, Mr. Chair, to give you an exhaustive analysis of the constitutionality of the Dash 6 amendments, but I will certainly pass it along to our cooperating attorneys and get back to you. My first reading is I believe it would not comply with the federal constitutional standards. And Mr. Chair, you may also be aware that back in the early 80s there was an Oregon case challenging limitations on Medicaid abortions, Planned Parenthood versus Hegstrom. The Court of Appeals held that there is a right to obtain abortions on the part of women under the Oregon Constitution. That decision was affirmed by the Oregon Supreme Court on other grounds, subconstitutional grounds, but we believe the Court of Appeals decision is still good law.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your coming. And we'd welcome your later reaction to the Dash 6 amendments.
Thanks.
Thank you. I understand that Representative Lundquist is here with us. I'm sorry I didn't spot you before, Representative. We will temporarily recess the hearing on House Bill 3583 and convene the public hearing on House Bill 3492, sponsored by Representative Lundquist. And we'll go into public hearing and ask Representative Lundquist to come forward. I'll ask counsel to summarize that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly, what this bill does is mimics the current law for minor in possession of alcohol products, and instead of alcohol, it focuses on tobacco. Much of the language proposed by the bill is the same, and this would provide that a person commits the offense by purchasing, attempting to purchase, or acquiring tobacco products if they are under the age of 18, and this is punished by community service and loss of driving privileges for a period of up to a year if the crime was committed through misrepresentation of age.
Good morning, Representative Lundquist. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Mannix.
I hope I didn't keep you waiting long, Director. No. I apologize.
No, that's fine. And committee members, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you. Let me give you just a little bit of background of this. The reason that this concept idea has come forward really is that the grocery industry had talked to me, you know, a year or so ago about the aspect of having sting operations by the OLCC and also with the tobacco industry, and the responsibility so many times is simply just placed on the industry itself. And I believe they should have that responsibility, and this is not an attempt to do anything to relieve the industry in any way. But I happen to believe that there needs to be responsibility on the part of our teenagers as well. And as the administrator did depict to you, this is trying to mimic basically the alcohol aspect of our regulations in regard to attempt to buy. As it is now, it is not a crime. There's nothing wrong with someone under 18 trying to buy tobacco products. And I think that we should put that responsibility back on the kids as where it belongs, as well as the industry itself. We have the Dash 2 amendments before you, and what those have tried to do, and I believe they do accomplish that task, is that the law enforcement agencies wanted to make sure that they still had an ability to do their sting operations, as well as any adult supervised programs, because I understand there are some communities that do take some teenagers, attempt to buy cigarettes, and use that without any punitive aspect to it at all, but as an educational process to their stores, particularly in their communities. So this exempts the law enforcement agency. It exempts also the adult supervised programs. Some of the people have talked to me and said, Lynn, well, it's fine to put this on, but, you know, where do we have the resources to enforce it? I understand that's an issue. Likewise, the same thing is true with alcohol. But I think we need to send a message. And I believe that the communities can utilize this as one of the methods by which to enhance the prevention process of tobacco purchases. Is it magic by itself? Absolutely not. But I absolutely believe that it's a message that we need to send. And I tried on some of my teenagers in my own community, and I just proposed to them the question. I said, suppose you went in and you tried to buy tobacco products, and you know, you were turned down. Have you done anything wrong? Well, no. And I think that's wrong. I think that's a wrong message to send to our teenagers. They truly believe out there that as long as they don't get caught, it's fine. In other words, as long as they try, but they don't actually get by the product. And that's true of whether it's alcohol or tobacco. And this is an attempt to bring those two products into a similar situation.
Thank you, Representative Lundquist. I appreciate your dedication, which dealt with a significant concern about whether or not sting operations could be authorized. I see that Bob Smith from the State Police is here. I assume that was one of your concerns. Let me ask briefly, while you're still up, Representative Lundquist, Mr. Captain Smith, if you'd come forward for a moment, and I'm just trying to save some folks a little time here. Was that the one issue, or did you have other issues you wanted to testify to in regard to this bill?
Mr. Chair, yes. And for the record, Captain Bob Smith, Oregon State Police. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. Specific interest was in relationship to Dash 2, is it?
And as long as the Dash 2 amendments are contained in this bill, then you have a comfort level. Those are the ones that allow the use of a minor under the direction of law enforcement for sting operations.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. I just wanted to give you a chance to testify on the record as to that. And you're welcome to stay and testify at further length later if you wish, but I thought I'd give you a chance, if you need to get off the hook, and because I don't think this bill's going anywhere unless it has the dash two amendments in it, and maybe it has other changes to be considered. I don't know. I'm leaving that door open, but from what I've heard, that was a major concern, and I think that it's important that Representative Lundquist has come forward with that, and we appreciate that. Thank you, Captain.
Thanks, sir.
You can stand down. Questions for Representative Lundquist, Representative Bowman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Representative Lundquist. Is it currently illegal for someone under 18 to have possession of tobacco products?
My belief is that it is.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair. I guess my only concern, Representative Lundquist, about the bill is, if, in fact, we suspend young people's driving privileges for having possession, well, actually, I have a couple of concerns, but I'll name one first. If we suspend young people's driving privileges for having possession of tobacco, and tobacco is, in fact, still, at least today, a legal product, then are we, in fact, creating young people who will be, in fact, driving on the roads without a driver's license because it's been suspended?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, there's always that potential. Anytime we take a driver's license away from anybody for any reason, they can still drive, and they do. But that's a decision that they make.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair. But Representative Lundquist, I think I don't see anything in this bill about how to get young people immediately into tobacco treatment programs. And so my concern is we're making young people criminals, but we're not providing them with the resources to be able to kick a tobacco habit if they have that issue.
Mr. Chair,
whoever the
owner is. Okay. I was searching for the gavel. I couldn't see it. Mr. Chair, Reverend Bowman, there is nothing in this bill. There are other programs that we have, and I have another bill that is going to talk that attacks the idea of prevention in K-12 that I hope will make it through the process. And your point is well taken. My point is simply that I believe they need to have the responsibility. And right now they have no responsibility, and they can go ahead and try, and if they're successful, you know, fine, and if they're not, they haven't done anything wrong. And I think that's wrong. They need to understand that they're breaking the law when they attempt to buy.
Mr. Chair, whoever that may be, if I could follow up.
Follow-up question.
Representative Lundquist, what about the place that they purchase the tobacco product from? Do they not have a responsibility to ensure that they are not selling to anyone who it is not legal for them to sell to?
Mr. Chair, everyone, that is correct. This is not an attempt to reduce that responsibility in any way. I think they need that. I'm just simply saying both parties ought to be responsible.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Who's going to pay the $500 fine?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, I think that would vary from family to family. In my case, the kid would pay for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions from the committee for Representative Lundquist? Yes, Representative Gianella.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lundquist, do you think this is do you think this will prevent teenagers from getting hooked on cigarettes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gianella, there is no silver bullet for making that happen. This is just one of the arrows in our quiver for that. There are other, and like I said, I have another bill that I want to work with that as well. I believe it helps. I do believe that if the young people in both alcohol and tobacco, if they really knew that they were breaking the law and that if some of them were going to lose their driver's license, you will make an impact. Will it be 100%? Absolutely not. And that's why I think probably the driver's license probably has more threat than the $500 does. So I think it's a step in the right direction, but not the answer by itself.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
when I was 16, driver's license was the most important thing in the world to me, and I think it would be quite a deterrent. Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Representative Lundquist.
I was 20 when I got my driver's license, so it wouldn't have any impact on me at all.
David Fleming?
I got it on my birthday.
Didn't need it. I live in a big city. Started smoking and got my driver's license at the same time, actually.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. David Fleming. I'm the state epidemiologist for the Oregon Health Division. Good morning. The Health Division has two concerns about House Bill 3492. One of them has been dealt with the Dash 2 amendments, but our second and more significant concern has not. Holding children responsible for attempting to purchase tobacco is a partial and unbalanced solution to this problem. Clerks are liable in Oregon for selling tobacco to minors already, but this bill leaves out one very important additional group, and that is the retail owners themselves. There is no Oregon statute that holds the owners of retail establishments liable for the sale of tobacco to minors, even though this is an illegal activity. And unfortunately, we have a serious problem in Oregon. According to the most recent data that we have, 29% of tobacco retail establishments sold tobacco to minors in compliance check operations. And these numbers are even worse when we look at what kids themselves tell us. Among student smokers in the state, children smokers in the state, 57% of them report that they were successful in buying tobacco from retail establishments every single time they tried in the past month. Now, clearly, there are many, many conscientious retailers in Oregon who are doing the right thing, who are checking ID, who are keeping their product behind the counter, who have training programs for their clerks in place. But unfortunately, not all retailers are this conscientious, as evidenced by this information that I've just given to you. The overwhelming majority of Oregonians believe that it's easy for our kids to purchase tobacco in our communities, and they're right. 97% of Oregonians in a statewide survey we've just conducted said that it's important to keep stores from selling tobacco to our kids. Now, we join all Oregonians and the supporters of this bill in wanting to solve this problem, but the Health Division believes that a blame-the-kids-only approach to this is not going to be effective. All parties need to be held responsible if we expect to reduce the illegal sale of tobacco to minors. For these reasons, we urge you to vote no on House Bill 3492. Thank you.
Questions from the committee for Mr. Fleming?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fleming, I guess for me, when I listen to testimony on this bill, it just raised another concern. When I go to, I spend a lot of time in high schools, and there are a lot of high school students that look a whole lot older than I do. And so it raises the point for me about how this bill would be implemented on the street level. I mean, does everybody who looks under a certain age, are they going to be stopped by police? And if they have a tobacco product in their possession and asked to present ID, for me, that's a big concern about this bill. There are some very old-looking high school students as well as some very young-looking adults, and I see this as a civil liberty issue that could get out of control. Any comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, we need to attack this problem through multiple approaches, in my opinion, and the single most important and critical place to prevent the sale of tobacco to minors is at the time that sale occurs by insisting that picture ID be available, and if it is not checked and if tobacco is sold to underage, holding all parties responsible for that sale, including the owner of the establishment.
That's a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fleming, the current law would fine the clerk who sold the tobacco product. Is that correct?
Representative Bowman, that is correct.
Okay. And so if we were to move this bill forward, you'd be interested in an amendment
or could support an amendment that would also hold the store owner accountable for that sale.
Representative Bowman, that is correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'll throw this out relatively facetiously, but I'm convinced that we do have to hold both parties of a sale responsible, both the youth and the seller. I mean, that seems fair, and that seems maybe the concept would be that we would also suspend the driver's license of the clerk and the store owner. And that would maintain the same balance and the same penalty.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, that's a step in the right direction, I think.
Dr. Fleming, I have a question for you. What if we change this bill to say, first of all, any governmental program in terms of tobacco law enforcement which wants to use minors is free to do so, not just law enforcement, but cities, counties, any kind of program that's established by any governmental unit to try to reduce the transfer of tobacco to minors is exempt. But second of all, it is illegal otherwise for a minor to attempt to purchase tobacco and then just say, that's a violation, fine of no more than $500, sanction of community service, set aside the driving privilege issue. To narrow it down to say, if you're under the age of, 18, you can't go in and try to buy tobacco unless you're participating in some governmental program. And if you do, set aside the driving privileges issue, but it's a violation, not a crime, and you could be fined up to $500 or sentenced to community service. Does that make this something that is a little warmer and fuzzier for you?
Mr. Chair, we believe that that approach is a partial and unbalanced approach, and unless we hold all parties responsible for the sale...
Well, I don't want to exempt the sellers, please. I'm talking, leave everything else in place. I'm talking about an additional... Right now, it is not a violation if I'm 16 years old to try to purchase. And so we just say, if you're not participating in some program and you walk in and try to purchase, that is a violation. And everything else still stays in place. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Mr. Chair, I think you may have been out when I made one point in my testimony, so let me just repeat
Please,
it.
Please, go ahead.
Under current Oregon law, there is no fine that is levied against the owner of a retail establishment for selling tobacco to minors.
And why is that?
Well, that's a good question, Mr. Chair.
So maybe we should make it a violation both ways, at least for the knowing sale. Of course, most of the time they'll say they didn't know, and then we'll deal with the rest of the process.
Mr. Chair, we would support the approach of a balanced approach to this problem. But the issue right now is that 30% of retail establishments in Oregon are selling to minors, and most kids know which stores those are and are using those stores to buy tobacco. Under current Oregon law, there is no pressure that can be brought to bear by a community against the owners of those establishments to prevent that sale.
So if we made this a two-edged sword, we'll even go beyond knowingly and say recklessly, which means that you're aware of a risk and you consciously disregard the risk, meaning I should have asked for that person's ID and I didn't, or I got an ID and it showed a bearded man who looked 60 years old and, gee, that doesn't look like you, you know, you might be 20, but you're not 60. Some ridiculous extreme. If we said that someone, a seller recklessly sells to a minor, reckless disregard, and then the minor, of course, we talk about the attempt or the purchase by the minor. How about that?
Sure. I think in many instances, it's the clerk that would be responsible under Oregon law for that selling. But we know both from experience within Oregon as well as in other states that owners can put systems in place in their stores such that their clerks will not sell. And we would encourage that the responsibility for this problem extend over to the owner, beyond the person that's just handling the product and handing it to the minor, but to the owner of the establishment as well.
Let's play with this a little further, if you don't mind.
Sure.
What if we said strict liability? You furnish to a minor, it's a violation. The individual who does it can be fined, let's make it $50. The store who employs that individual can be fined $100 per episode. Strict liability. And then on the other side, the minor who attempts or who purchases, we still make that a violation, and a sanction of up to $500, maybe it should be up to $100, a lower level. Something to say, minors shouldn't try to play, we'll hold them accountable. Stores will be held strictly liable. Forget knowingly.
Right.
Such as furnishing to a minor alcohol to a minor is a strict liability offense.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with that approach. I would encourage you to consider that the penalties that are levied against the owner be at least as significant as those that are assessed against the clerk or the minor, and perhaps even more so given the relative inequity of the amount of cash reserves that the parties in this may have.
But we also know that the clerk might have made a mistake. The owner might have made a mistake. We know the minor didn't make a mistake. The minor knows how old he or she is. So there is, but I understand too, there's a relative resources. What I'm just saying to you is this, plain and simple. We have a bill in front of us. It may be an opportunity to improve enforcement. And I didn't pick up, and I did miss your testimony. I was out for a few minutes. I agree with the equitable argument. It should be a two-edged sword, and we should look at the economic resources. We have a bill here. We have a potential vehicle. In its current form, I see that we have some problems. But I suggest that you look at this as an opportunity for improvement rather than something that you need to simply oppose.
We'd be happy to work with the chair or whoever you would designate to come back with some proposals.
I would encourage you to talk to Representative Lundquist about some of these ideas and certainly bring them back to us. But please remember that the magical witching hour for us is a week from tomorrow, after which we can only hear, work bills with special permission. And I do appreciate your input on this. It's very helpful. Representative Hansen has a question or a comment.
Well, I'll just throw one out that you sometimes encourage wacky ideas. One of those might be after repeated violations, a store to lose the privilege of selling tobacco products might be at the end of the road, and I think a very strong enforcement tool.
Let's keep that in mind, too. Are you listening in, AOI?
I'm sure they are. They're on their way over.
Mr. Chair, what I'd like to suggest is that we tie this into getting the young people into a tobacco elimination program. You know, we're talking about, you know, whether it's $50, $100, whether or not it should be a driver's license. What is our goal? If our goal is to get young people to not use tobacco products, and we have an opportunity because this young person has been caught with tobacco products, then let's use that opportunity to get them into some program so that they are no longer going to be possibly falling under this category of getting violations for using tobacco. That's what I'd like to see happen. I'd be happy to work with Representative Lundquist and anybody else to see that we think about what the outcome is that we're looking for.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Doctor. We appreciate your coming. I had pulled us off the earlier public hearing, and I'm going to get us back now. I have to try to keep things moving for everybody concerned. I'm trying to be considerate of everybody's schedules. We will temporarily recess the public hearing on House Bill 3492. I will advise everyone for the record there's not going to be a work session on that bill or any other bill today, so rest assured about that. But we will move back into the public hearing in House Bill 3583. Bob Castagna, thank you for your patience. Please come up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bob Castagna representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. Mr. Chair, the Oregon Catholic Conference is here today to testify in support of House Bill 3583. I'd like to read into the record some statements regarding the medical consensus that has emerged regarding partial birth abortion. President Clinton has said that he can support a ban on partial birth abortions if it is shown that a ban will not endanger women's health or future fertility. Recently, he said, what I need to do is to be convinced that no woman will be grievously harmed and that no woman will be put in a position of being so harmed that she will never be able to have further children. Assurances on this point are now readily available. Prominent medical organizations and medical experts who disagree about abortion in general all agree that the partial birth abortion procedure is never medically necessary. From a report of the Board of Trustees of the American Medical Association in May 1997, we find, according to the scientific literature, there does not appear to be any identified situation in which intact DNX is the only appropriate procedure to induce abortion, and ethical concerns have been raised about DNX. In the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists Statement of Policy, January 1997, we find a select panel convened by ACOG could identify no circumstances under which this procedure would be the only option to save the life or preserve the health of the woman. From former U.S. Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, in American Medical News, August 96, he's quoted as saying, "I believe that Mr. Clinton was misled by his medical advisors on what is fact and what is fiction in reference to late-term abortions, because in no way can I twist my mind to see that the late-term abortion as described, you know, partial birth and then destruction of the unborn child before the head is born, is a medical necessity for the mother. It certainly can't be a medical necessity for the baby." And there are other statements on the form that I've handed out to you. We believe this gruesome procedure contributes to and is a part of the culture of death. We believe it is good public policy to enact such a statute as other states have done, as U.S. Congress has attempted to do and only been vetoed. We need to restore our respect for life, and this bill is a step in that direction.
Thank you, Mr. Castagna. I appreciate your coming this morning, and I apologize for keeping you waiting.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3583? I will note again that Representative Close was here earlier, and because I was dealing with some other things, I had not called her up. I will, solely for purposes of allowing Representative Close to testify if she comes in before we adjourn, I will recess the public hearing on House Bill 3583. What that means is if Representative Close comes back, I'll reconvene to let her testify. Now, if someone comes in late, thought we were going to be going all morning, I'll certainly bring that person up. We will move into our public hearing on House Bill 3342, which we had recessed. We'll reconvene. 3342. And, Captain, I think you're here to testify. I haven't quite got my sheet in front of me, but come on up.
Mr. Chair, we're on the floor this morning at 10:15.
Good morning and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Captain Greg Williford, Director of the Department's Uniform Patrol Services Division of the Oregon State Police. I've handed out for you formal testimony, which I will just summarize in the sake of brevity, and just highlight some of the points and issues here. I appear before you today in support of House Bill 3342 that would require funding an additional 250 uniformed patrol troopers for the Oregon State Police during the 99-01 biennia. Since 1931, members of your Oregon State Police Patrol Division have been responsible for providing a full-service police function throughout communities in Oregon relative to transportation safety, response to crime and enforcement of criminal law, response to natural disasters around the state, and support for both local communities and local law enforcement public safety agencies. And that mission does continue today. However, it has been, due to our shrinking resources, more difficult to do in the last several years. In 1979, as the Union President Jim Botwinus had mentioned, our funding source changed for the Patrol Division for our patrol activities from the State Highway Fund to the General Fund. It became a general fund obligation. And today, that percentage of general fund that goes to support your Oregon State Police Patrol Division is at its lowest since it was removed from general funding 19 years ago. It is about 0.6%. Of the entire general fund goes to support your Oregon State Troopers patrol activities. That's about 6 cents on every general fund dollar today. During that same time, we've seen, during the last 19 years, we've had about a 37% decrease in uniformed troopers in the division, the road strength of troopers and sergeants. We had 641 19 years ago as our road strength. Today it's 399 throughout the state. And as the union president mentioned, during that same time, we've seen a significant increase in our state's population, the number of registered vehicles increase, the number of licensed drivers, and the miles traveled on our highways has increased well over 64% during that same period of time, as we saw a decline in our resources. To be quite candid, the level of resources we have in our patrol division today is unacceptable to effectively meet the service demands and requirements of local communities and our local law enforcement partners. We are trying to do the best we can by partnering and being very strategic and tactical in the way we deploy our resources, but it's still very difficult to do. And in the testimony, you'll see some examples there that we provide as far as things we're not proud of, but where we're having difficulty. Just in the area of a call for service, for example, in 97, there was over 8,000 calls for service that we had no trooper, we coded no patrol available. Of those, over 2,000 were reported drunk drivers. Over 5,000 were a driving complaint of some kind, and I can tell you that if people take the time to call the Oregon State Police when they're on the road, when they see a driving complaint, there must be something really wrong there, and we had no patrol available. We also code in those calls about 9,000 that went to other agencies, because if it's a serious call, obviously, and it's not a moving target and we can get somebody there in law enforcement, we will refer it to another agency or we'll roll somebody out of bed. And we have done that. But about 9,000 were coded that year for referred to other agencies. And about half of those, we believe, are legitimately OSP calls on the state and interstate highways. In 1980, or just last year, 98, those same trends, those same levels and numbers of calls for service were repeated. I'd like to talk a little bit about our budget as far as where we are in our budget request. The governor's recommended budget that is before this legislature requested 25 additional uniformed patrol positions. He also indicated his desire to increase that to a level of 100. Just yesterday, our budget was voted out of the subcommittee Ways and Means, Public Safety and Regulation. And with a due pass recommendation, it has 100 additional uniformed trooper positions in there, funded primarily from the state general fund, phased in through the next biennium. And we certainly support that. We see that an additional 100 troopers within our patrol division is a very positive, hopeful first step in bridging our community service gap. During the last 15 months, the agency-wide, patrol division and other divisions went and performed a resource gap analysis with our local partners and communities to determine the level of services expected and required in each community and by our public safety partners for patrol resources. And that gap came up to an additional 416 uniformed troopers to really bridge and meet the needs that are out there today. So the 100 positions will certainly help in bridging that. We also know that the governor is interested in seeking a more stable funding source and getting the State Police Patrol Division back into the State Highway Fund. And there are three bills, one of his, HGR 1, that would attempt to do that this legislative session. We see that as something we obviously support, and we see that as a long-term, more stable option perhaps for additional uniformed troopers and bridging that resource gap of 316 additional positions. We believe that based on the way that we do our business and that what our communities have told us what their needs are for uniformed troopers and what our public safety partners have indicated they need from us, that bridging our resource gap will have a positive impact and will reestablish a visible and consistent uniformed presence on our state and interstate highways that will have an effect, positive effect on transportation safety issues and concerns, and also have a positive effect on responding and reducing crime that occurs on interstate highways. With that, I'm going to conclude, although I would like to refer to the bill specifically, and that is on line 8 of the proposed bill.
Line 8.
Just that it mentions that the department shall assign the members hired under this section to highway patrol, and we would recommend that term highway patrol mean the full-service police law enforcement function that your troopers in the patrol division performed for you today and have since 1931.
Should that read
should be hired under the section to police patrol activities in the patrol division.
Mr. Chair, yes, that could do that. I know we certainly anticipate that these would be within the patrol division. Patrol activities would do that. But your uniformed troopers have never been a highway patrol. They've been full-service law enforcement on your state and interstates.
That would sort of be like telling the corrections officers that they're guards.
Mr. Chair, that could be true.
Has it something to do with level of training and scope of service?
Yes.
I appreciate that sensitivity, Captain. Sergeant Bowman has a question for me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Captain, today. I have a couple of quick questions. One has to do with, it is my understanding that you have a significant amount of your force that will be retiring in the next, I think the figure I heard was 5-10 years. You're going to have like 50% of your force that will be retiring. So that, so obviously you'll need to replace those officers as well. And I understand that yesterday you said that there was, your normal Ways and Means process bill would allow 100 additional officers to be hired over the next biennium. My question is, why would we support this bill when the state police is a state agency that has to go through the Ways and Means process like every other state agency, like every other need that we have? Why would we want to separately support a bill that gives 25 additional officers more than what the governor requested, separate from the Ways and Means process? Why would we be doing this here? Why not make these compelling arguments down at the Ways and Means process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, the agency has been in the Ways and Means process since February, and my understanding is that this bill would have to have some referral. If it were to move out of this committee, it would have to go to a revenue or Ways and Means, perhaps, and be considered there. It is seeking these additional positions out of the state's general fund, and we know that the competition for those dollars and the difficulty in finding available revenues for additional state police resources. However, as an agency, we support bridging our service gap, and I think that's a policy decision. You're absolutely right. As far as that, it would have to go for the full presentation. We've done that in our Ways and Means process. However, we do support these bridging the gap, and it's a policy decision for this body, we believe, to determine how we get there as far as the funding.
Ms. Hanson.
Another thing I'll just throw out, obviously, because we don't have time to deal with it at this point. Clearly, the needs of public safety are great, and I think there's probably consensus that there's a shortage of uniformed officers patrolling our roads and streets. If we'd add 100 through this Ways and Means process of state police, what would you think of the concept of the next 100 being added as state grants to counties to add another additional 100 deputy sheriffs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, we certainly support local law enforcement. There are partners in throughout Oregon. However, we do as an agency believe that state funds should be used to support your state law enforcement and criminal justice system first.
Thank you very much, Captain. I appreciate your patience in waiting, and we appreciate your testimony this morning.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank you, and I want to specifically thank you and also Representative Gianella for your support in this bill and also for you and your support during our Ways and Means process. We appreciate it as an agency and very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here to testify? Oh, Representative Gianella would like to testify on her own bill. Would be nice. Come on down. Representative Gianella, please go ahead. Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, committee. For the record, my name is Julie Gianella, representative for District 38. Right now, Oregon is in need of more state troopers to help protect our citizens and promote safety on our highways. With a 32% decline of the Patrol Services Division in the past 18 years, and the population increasing 23%, in the number of licensed drivers in Oregon increasing 33%. The number of miles traveled on Oregon highways has increased over 64%. Oregon needs a sharp increase for the Patrol Services Division. Right now, the Patrol Services Division has 399 sergeants and troopers authorized by the legislature. That is 399 officers patrolling 2,782 licensed drivers, and this is unacceptable. Just the presence of more troopers patrolling our highways will make it so drivers on these roads will become more cautious to avoid being caught speeding or driving recklessly. This bill was one idea that I had to properly fund the much-needed increase in the number of state troopers on our highways and roads. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. We appreciate your sponsorship and your testimony. Seeing no further testimony on House Bill 3342, the hearing is adjourned. We are back into public hearing on House Bill 3492. We had two other witnesses who were signed up, although they seem to be out of the room. Maybe they gave up, or maybe they decided that the proposed compromise that we discussed would take care of their concerns. We're Kelly Taylor from ODOT and Jerry Spegman from the American. Are they here? I'm sorry, I missed you. Hi.
I got lost in the crowd.
What the crowded chair. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Maybe I need to get my glasses.
That's all right, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor. It's Department of Transportation, and I just have a brief comment. If the bill, and I heard some of the comments about maybe taking suspension out or in, I just wanted to put on the record that our fiscal relates to the suspension. Creating a new suspension type would require some programming. This is going to sound familiar. We're in the middle of Y2K. This bill is a 90-day bill. We would request that if the suspension part is left in, it be given a later operative date, perhaps March or April of 2000.
I can save you a little time on that. So. While there may be a lot of bills talking about suspension of driving privileges, and there are, the chair would be disinclined to let this bill proceed with that kind of baggage on this novel enforcement side of things.
Gotcha.
I think you can rest assured that if a trimmed-down version proceeds, it will not include suspension of driving privileges.
Then our fiscal would go away and our interest would go away as far as worrying about impact to us.
And I apologize for keeping you waiting so long to get the message across.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Jerry Spegman did leave us some written testimony, which we'll enter into the record, from the American Cancer Society. And we'll enter that into the record. Is there anyone else here to testify in House Bill 3492? Seeing no one else, that hearing is adjourned. I had left us in recess on House Bill 3583. Representative Close was in here at one point. I have since received written testimony from Representative Close on 3583. I will enter that into the record, and I assume that our two other persons here don't want to testify on this bill. Seeing no other witnesses on 3583, we are adjourned. That hearing is closed, and we're done.
Perfect timing.